Hello, this is UCI Chancellor Dr. Howard Gilman. When I'm not busy dealing with the regents of the University of California, I like to unwind with KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine or online at kuci.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this June 13th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. This morning is All Novels All the Time. I'm here now with Abby Waxman, and coming up in the second half hour, Kirsten Chen will talk to me about her latest, Bury What We Cannot Take. Actually, I will mention today's interviews are pre-recorded, so if something catastrophic has happened in the interim here, you will know why. Abby Waxman was born in England in 1970, the oldest child of two copywriters who never should have been together in the first place. Once her father ran off to buy cigarettes and never came back, her mother began a highly successful career in crime fiction. She encouraged Abby and her sister Emily to read anything and anything they could pull down from the shelves, and they did. Abby went into advertising, working as a copywriter and then a creative director at various advertising agencies in London and New York. Eventually, she quit advertising, had three kids, and started writing books, TV shows, and screenplays. She has two novels under her belt, The Garden of Small Beginnings and Other People's Houses, both published by Berkeley, a division of Penguin. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband, three kids, a menagerie of animals. Abby, welcome.
I'm very happy to be here. How lovely to speak to you again.
I know. So I will say the first thing to know about you is you're hilarious. So no pressure on that.
That's
no pressure to be
totally not true. Totally untrue. You've made that up completely.
We were together, I will tell listeners, on a panel at Literary Orange a few months back, and the audience could not stop laughing. So I said, there's a woman I need to talk to again. There's a woman I have to have on the show immediately. So.
And of course, I owe you money. So that's
right. Why. Yes, you do. That's right. I take PayPal and checks.
I shall Venmo you.
Yeah. So when we talked last time, we didn't have a chance, and I wanted to talk then about your copywriting and advertising career, because you had mentioned that that really had kind of helped you in the writing world, and I'd love to hear more about that and how it kind of helps you.
I think, honestly, that working as an advertising copywriter is probably the best preparation for being a professional writer of fiction. That it's possible to have. One, you're actually just writing fiction the whole time. You're basically being paid to lie for a living. And then you also, on a more serious note, have to write in a multitude of different voices for different kinds of products, talking to different kinds of audiences, you know, with different kinds of goals. Sometimes you're just trying to, you know, interest people in a product. Sometimes you're actually trying to sell a product. Like, there's a variety of different tasks, and all you really have are words. So it's very good practice for, you know, facility with language. And then in addition, it's extremely good practice for rejection because you're constantly having your work destroyed, ripped apart, and shat on from a height by a variety of people who don't know anything. So that's really good practice for, you know, learning to just sort of shrug it off and get back to work.
I hadn't appreciated that, but yeah, you're right. It is a lot of rejection.
Everybody has a comment, right? Everybody thinks they can write copy, and lots of people can. But then, you know, so if a client who doesn't know anything about writing will give you comments like, well, it's just not quite, you know, and then you're supposed to walk away and do something with that. It's a very good practice for trying to actually discern what it is people want, which is good practice anyway. Mm-hmm. And then for just sort of, it's not that you don't care about your work. You do care about the work, but you learn that it's easier to just let it go and do it over than it is to argue. Mm-hmm. Right. And 9 times out of 10, if not more, the work is better the second time around. So that's another thing. You get really used to the fact that just rewriting is just always going to improve your work.
That's interesting.
You know, and so it's very good. It's very good training. And besides, you can wear jeans and swear at work and, you know, drink a lot of coffee. So it's perfect, really. Perfect job.
It's the ideal job. It's funny because in my private or my prior life, I was a lawyer, and it was a lot of unlearning, not bad habits, but just very different writing habits. You know, the lawyerese does not translate to fiction whatsoever. So I felt like it took me, I don't know, a couple of years really to shrug off all of the formal language and get into fiction. It really was a disservice to me in a lot of ways. So I wanted to chat with you about that. It is true.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that it certainly informed. Well, I mean, it's hard to tell what came first, right? Because I feel like I have a very informal. I'm sorry, I'm just letting my dog in. Thank you. A very informal writing style. Like I wouldn't call myself a great writer at all. I would say that I am good at creating characters because that's the bit I enjoy the most. And I think I am good, if I'm good at anything, it's being an easy read.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think people find my work easy to read and sort of pleasant and enjoyable to read. And that, I think, comes directly out of advertising because it's always supposed to be, as David Ogilvy said, one intelligent person talking to another.
Uh-huh.
Right? So if you do your job, advertising shouldn't feel like advertising. It should just feel like a conversation.
Right.
That's not actually the truth anymore. I think people are so aware of advertising and are so astute about it that those days are gone. But nonetheless, that should be the goal. And so that has stuck with me. Like I don't, you know, I get uncomfortable if it feels too formal.
I was just talking with somebody the other day about how the goal of fiction is to make it feel like a magic trick. So, you know, on the sentence level, it's really tough to achieve, but the effect is that it's so easy and so breezy and you know, the words kind of fall away and you're trapped in this world and you're not even aware that you're reading. You're not even aware of the words. And if you're doing it well, as I would say, you do it so well where you just kind of forget you're reading and you're just living alongside these characters. And that's a trick. That's not that easily accomplished. So
that's certainly the goal, right? I mean, yeah. When I read a book that is like that, and there are so many good books. I feel like it's a reader's paradise these days. There are so many good books coming out and so many good books that have always been there, of course, that, you know, when you have that feeling where you close a book and you're like, why, time has passed. I can't believe it. Like, you know, the things have actually happened while I've been off doing this entire other thing. That's a fantastic feeling. There's nothing to touch it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you grew up in England. And I was wondering if there's sort of a different sensibility about the novel there than you would get if you grew up in the U.S. I feel like the British are, I don't know, you're more funny than Americans. I don't know. That's a
we're
gross
hilarious.
Generalization.
No, we're complete. Oh, my God. We're all, every single one of us, without exception, we're all hilarious. No, I think there is obviously these are ridiculous overgeneralizations. But I think in general, British people, as soon as there's two or more in the room, one of them is trying to make the other one laugh.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's always, the goal is always to make someone else laugh. And we have a tendency to always look on the funny side of disaster.
Yeah.
Maybe because we've been invaded continuously since we started.
Yep.
And so we're just sort of used to things just constantly going wrong and it rains all the time and the food is really bad. And so you sort of have to make the best of it. And so we tend to laugh at each other and ourselves really quickly. Whereas I think Americans take themselves a little bit more seriously, at least at first blush. And then when you actually, I've lived here now longer than I lived in England, so it's really hard for me to, with my hand on my heart, comment on how things are in England these days, because I really don't know. But
it's hard to comment on how things are here, too, I would say.
Yes, true. Things change so quickly lately.
Right?
Things change so quickly here, as Dorothy would say. But it's... I'm sorry, I've lost my train of thought. It's quite right. The more I live here, the longer I live here, and the more Americans I become really good friends with, the more I realize that's just not true. Americans are just as funny as British people in many of the same ways. You're just not as, you're more friendly in general. Like everyone is much more friendly up front. Mm. But then to get to the sort of sarcastic heart of an American, you have to get to know them quite a bit better. Whereas an English person will trot out the sarcasm on first meeting.
That's pretty so interesting. Insight.
You know, I think humans are funny in the same way all over.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that you, when that gets revealed is a cultural difference.
Yeah. 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 And your observation about the weather, I do think people are funnier in the rain. I don't know why, but California.
They are. I mean, I lived in Manhattan for a long time when I first got here. I was there for 12 years before I moved to the West Coast. And New Yorkers are much more like British people than Californians are.
Uh-huh.
So
yes.
I don't know whether it's easterliness or whether it's just that, you know, cold and damp, hideous weather brings out. I mean, ultimately, you have to laugh because it's not going to stop raining.
Right.
In California, everyone's pretty good-humored, you know, because it's gorgeous here. So there's really no need to get depressed about it.
We're vapid and shallow. No, it's true. It's true.
We are, in the nicest of ways.
Right.
I love California. I'm very, very patriotic about California. I really am. I've become quite the devotee of this state.
I'm never leaving, that's for sure. Yeah, the weather here
is
not
good. Oh, no, me neither.
But I have this whole theory I'll share with you about Californians, especially Southern Californians, and plastic surgery, which is that because we don't experience the passage of time and the change of seasons, we don't experience the passage of time on our bodies. And so every time we look in the mirror, we're just shocked because yesterday felt exactly the way it did 10 years ago because it's always 72 degrees and sunny, you know, as opposed to pulling out your winter boots and your coats and, you know, actually experiencing time going by. We just don't. You know, it's a shock when it happens to our own face because we don't, it looks the same, you know, in our front yard.
No, I totally get it. No, I think it's a very good theory because in England, you're so hammered over the head with every single day you get up and, oh, it's another day and you have to pull on your Wellingtons that, you know, no wonder you look like crap. You know, it's not a surprise at all to discover that you have aged a million years because, you know, every minute has seemed like an hour.
Right.
So I get your theory.
Well, let's dive into the book, or even both books, if you want to. Well, let's focus on other people's houses and kind of set the stage for the novel, in case people haven't read it. What was on your mind while you were writing it, kind of the inspiration for it, and take us into this neighborhood.
Okay. Well, it's written about the neighborhood that I actually live in, which is a real neighborhood called Larchmont in Los Angeles, which many people might have visited. It's a very sort of twee little English village pretending to be an American neighborhood, or the other way around, because it's towards downtown. It's sort of stuck between, it's like north of Koreatown, south of Hollywood, and east of Hancock Park. It's sort of a strange little brigadoon of the neighborhood, and it really is like a village. There's a main street with lots of shops and cafes and restaurants, and then a very nice residential area around it, and people walk to the store and they know each other, and it does really behave like a village. It's very strange. And then just outside, of course, is the rest of the city. So maybe it's more like an island, but whatever it is, it's a little sort of closed community, and it's full of sort of, it's not as hip as some of the other neighborhoods, but it's full of lots of artists and writers and people who are sort of tangentially attached to the movie business, but not like famous people.
Mm-hmm.
So set designers and, you know, production people and things and screenwriters, things like that. So it has this sort of artsy, we wish we were 10 years younger, we're still sort of hip and we wear Converse, but at the same time we have hemorrhoids kind of people.
Yep.
And so it has a very distinct feeling to it. And it is also stuffed to the gills with children. It's like a lot of families living here. So you have literally dozens and dozens of children all living in a very small area, which means you have this strange sort of anachronistic, you know, the children play with each other in the street at night, you know, and they run around and do neighborhood things, which you don't get to do in a lot of different places in the city. So it's sort of weird. And we're all aware that it's weird and we enjoy that it's weird. And we're a little bit embarrassed at our own good fortune in living here. So anyway, so I was interested in what would happen if somebody, one member of a group of neighbors in this neighborhood just destroyed the whole thing, just blew the whole thing up by having an affair. And so basically that's what I did. I have a group of families. They all live on the same block. They carpool their kids to school together. That's how they know each other so intimately and how the kids are all friends. And then one of the mothers has an affair with a much younger chap, and the whole thing just goes kablooey.
Yeah, and there's a gay couple.
What would happen?
Yeah. So
there's a gay couple. There's a couple of straight married couples. There are people without kids, people with kids. Like I was interested in how one event will affect everybody differently and the same, right? All of them are sort of surprised. They're shocked and horrified. Some are really judgy. Some are trying not to be judgy. Some are like, that would never happen to me. And others are like, oh my God, that could happen to me. So I was sort of interested in how a simple thing, a fairly common, sadly, thing could affect all of these very different people in very different ways. And then I was also interested in talking about how it affects the children, because my generation, Generation X, lots of us had divorced parents. Like, it was very, very common. In fact, I was trying to explain to my children the other day, who don't literally have maybe one kid that they know in their, of the dozens of kids they know, whose parents are divorced, that it, right now they're in a sort of lull. you know, that when I was their age, that everybody was divorced, right? So this is a totally different thing. And they were really surprised by this. But I think it's really bad for kids, and so I wanted to write about that as well. So
it's interesting.
And also, I'm just interested in the minutiae of life, the sort of the mundane stuff that has to carry on even though disaster is happening.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the book is about that, how you have to continue to go to the grocery store even if your underpants are on fire, and you have to continue to pay the bills even though you cannot speak to your partner because you're so angry with them, and things like that, because I think that happens, and I find it interesting.
It is interesting how I kind of saw this neighborhood like a mobile, and you know, if you, you know, those mobiles over your kid's crib, and if one element of it moves, the whole thing gets thrown out of whack, and how everybody then starts viewing their own marriage through the lens of this other person's infidelity. And then I started thinking, you know, to our point earlier about the difference between the U.S. and Britain, and whether it's, you know, Americans just strike me as so prudish. And every time somebody has an affair, we're renewedly manufacture surprise all over again. But I think it's a real surprise. I think people really are taken off by it. But it kind of seems like an American thing that we're so intolerant and so kind of uptight. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, I think America is quite a puritanical country.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're still dealing with the Salem witch trials. That's how it feels every day.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're still hanging people out to dry in the court of public opinion all the time here, which, to be fair, we do in England also. I mean, we have very famous, awful tabloid press in England who love to, you know, tear people down. And in England, we also have, and so does Australia, actually, have this idea of the tall poppy, that if you become too successful, that it then becomes everybody's job to make sure that you suffer for it. America doesn't have that part of it, but there is a sort of puritanical judgment, which, I don't know, I think there's a tendency to sort of dehumanize people these days in a way that I think is really dangerous. You know, that, and on a very interpersonal level, that means that when your neighbor has an affair, you know, you immediately are like, well, she is clearly, or he is clearly not the same person that I thought they were. They are not a good person, rather than just being human about it and saying, wow, they messed up, or, you know, that, you know, let's try and be a little bit kind about it. I think there's sort of a lack of kindness in the public discourse right now that is alarming.
Yeah. I know. I was thinking, you know, the Me Too movement couldn't take place in France or Italy because it's just a way of life. I thought it was kind of a unique.
Yeah, it is. Although it's, I don't know, the Me Too movement thing is strange because on the one hand, great, you know, we don't want bad actors, you know, being allowed to get away with crappy behavior.
Yeah.
But on the second hand, you know, we cannot rush to judge people without due process.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, you can't, it's challenging. I think it's a very interesting time, and I think that the millennials are coming into their own a little bit, and I think I'm really interested to see how they change the culture.
Yeah.
And so my book that I'm finishing right now has a millennial heroine, and I've been spending a lot of time sort of talking to and being with people younger than myself. And I don't know, they're an interesting bunch.
Yeah.
They really are.
Well, to our point that we were talking about on the panel too, how social mores are so at odds with human nature. And, you know.
Oh, really? They totally are, yeah. They really are. And it's, I don't know, I wonder sometimes why that is. You know, there's sort of a general sort of disinclination to accept our own humanity, although we're forever cutting ourselves plenty of slack.
Right.
You know,
right.
But yes, I don't know. Whenever I see someone in a disastrous situation, I'm painfully aware that it could so easily be me.
Yeah.
You know, I very rarely look. That's not true. If I had suddenly cancelled a summit with a major world power, for example, that would be surprising for me. I would not have done that. But, you know, I'm like, well, I guess that could happen to anyone.
It's a shame this interview is airing 3 weeks from now, because by the time...
God knows what'll have happened.
Right, right. 3 weeks in this world is, you know, geez, who knows?
I know. In fact, it's exciting. Who knows it's what
exciting.
Will happen?
Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. So let's talk about the point of origin into the novel and whether it was... I know I've asked you this before and I've already forgotten the answer, but I can't remember if it started with a character, if it started... I know it kind of started with working around your neighborhood. But, you know, at the point you kind of sat down to write the novel, was there a character that came to your mind? Was there an image that kind of started driving it? Or was it really just this neighborhood? And then how did you take that leap away from, you know, the people that you actually live next door to? Because I think they'd be perhaps horrified to find themselves reading about themselves.
Well, it serves them right. It started in a couple of ways, which is how things happened for me so far, at least, is that I'll have an idea for a character and I'll have an idea for a sort of a situation.
Okay.
And of less importance is the setting, actually, because that's not ever, it just happens. Usually I set my books whatever is most convenient to me. I'm never going to be, I'm not one of those people who's, I love to read them, but I'm never going to be one of those people who writes books that require a lot of research because you haven't been there, or like makes up some big mythical country.
Right.
Because that's less interesting to me as a writer, but I love it as a reader. Yeah. But so it started with the idea of the sort of person who we all know who is the really, really helpful mum,
uh-huh.
or mom, I guess you'd say here,
uh-huh.
the one who is everybody's emergency contact, the one who is usually has a more fluid working situation, so she's able to like leap in at a crisis, the one who you can always rely on and call in an emergency. We all know that person. And often those are women, and I guess potentially men too, who hold a group of families together, right? There's always one person who you're like, oh my God, I can't do this, or I can't pick up this kid from there, I'm going to call X, right? And
yeah.
you know that they'll step in. And so I wanted to write about that person, because I was also interested in how annoyed that person might actually be on the inside, like whether that person really is a saint or whether she's actually just fuming.
Hmm.
And then I wanted something bad to happen to this group of people and see what happened. And it's always a combination of things. And it originally started because every time I would be in a carpool line, which was many times, we all, you know, when you're sitting in the car waiting for your kids to come out of something,
mm-hmm.
I would be overcome with this terrible feeling of like ennui every time. I'd be sitting there in the line to pick up my kids from summer camp. And I'd be like, oh my God, this is just the most boring way to spend time ever. Now, I mean, I'm not ice fishing in the Bering Strait, right? So it's really not a painful way to spend time. It's just boring, and it's the same thing every day, and it's so unappreciated as well. You're just sitting there counting the moments of your life,
right.
you know, dip towards zero, as your children, who are totally unaware that you exist until they lay eyes on you, right? That basically you've been standing around waiting for them. Then they come out, and now you exist again. And I was suddenly like, I bet everybody else in this car line feels the same way. Or do they, you know? And then you start wondering about everybody else. Does everybody feel this way? Is everybody as bored by this process as I am?
Yeah.
Or are other people like, oh my God, carpool? It's like the peak moment of my day.
Can't wait for carpool.
Yeah. Just counting down the moments until I can sit behind that wheel again.
So was Frances the most challenging for you? She's the main, though she's kind of the mom of the neighborhood. Was she difficult for you to access?
No, she was the...
She was the easiest. Okay.
Because she's the most like me personally and the most relaxed character. So she's very mellow.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to worry, you know, she didn't, right until the end, she keeps her temper the whole time, right? Eventually,
yeah.
not to give anything away, but eventually she does blow her stack. But it takes a lot because that's just her nature. She's very, very mellow. And so it was easy to write her because there wasn't a great deal of tension that
yeah.
I needed to sort out. It was much harder for me to write Anne, the woman who has an affair, because that is more mysterious to me. Like, I had to work harder to try and understand where she might be, you know, how did that happen,
uh-huh.
you know, and what is she going to do with it now? And also I felt really bad for her,
uh-huh.
because she's actually someone who made a mistake and feels genuinely terrible about it. And, you know, and the sort of ability to make things, she tries very hard to avoid things going wrong, and she loses control of the situation and it all goes horribly wrong. And she is fully aware and 100% cognizant of what she has just done.
Right.
So, you know, that when we all mess up, right? We all mess up.
Yeah.
But sometimes there are just terrible, terrible consequences about which you can do nothing. And she's very, very aware that it's her fault that her children are devastated and that her husband is devastated and that the neighborhood is sort of in ruins. So she feels it very keenly.
It's interesting because somebody on our panel, I think Janelle Brown, when we were talking, said she gets to live out all of her, like the unexpressed aspects of her personality on the page that she couldn't do in real life. And so that's almost how this neighborhood felt. You were like, well, I'm never going to have an affair, but now I can kind of explore what that would be like psychologically and mentally and physically. Or, you know, I'm not a gay woman, or I'm not suffering through other things that people, I'm not going to give away, but things people are suffering through in the novel. But it's a way to express that part of yourself that you otherwise wouldn't have access to in the real world, you get to have access to in the fictional world.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point of writing, right? Yeah. Is you get to play act these different characters and think about, and I guess the better the writer you are, the more distinct those characters are. You know, I'm still relatively new to it, and so I try very hard to not have my characters all be too similar, but I think that's something that I struggle with, you know. So as I go along, I try harder and harder to distinguish the way characters respond and react and talk and behave and move from each other.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why it's easier for me to write Frances, because she's most, you know, she walks around in sweatshirt and jeans, you know, like a slob like I do. And so I was like, that I can do. Like, I can nail that character. But a woman who actually gets up in the morning and puts on makeup and, like, has matching underwear and stuff, I'm like, yeah.
It's a foreign animal, right?
Totally foreign to me. So, yeah, but it is. It's a way to... And writing is, in one way, no different from reading in that, right? I mean, you read books to escape or to experience different lives, if you're lucky. And I write for the same reason.
Yeah. How much
and
do you,
also because I'm compulsive.
Yeah. How much do you allow for the element of surprise in, you know, how and,
when,
and in what ways
I'm
did this? Yeah, when you're writing. I mean, did the whole thing just kind of shock you?
I'm constantly surprised. I have no idea what I'm going to do most of the time. I'm a complete nervous wreck the whole way.
Okay. Good.
And sometimes I panic to the extent that I stop writing and I furiously write everything down on index cards and stick it up on a board and look at it like, yes, I am mastering this novel. I know exactly where it's going to go and I feel so much better. But then usually within a couple of chapters of that, I'm lost again and I have no idea. No, the whole thing is seat of the pants. And the first book I wrote was it took a really long time just because of the nature, because I had children, little kids. And I couldn't really focus on it. It took me 7 years to write the first one because I had three kids under five, and it just wasn't, didn't have a lot of time. Mm. Then the second one took like 7 months because they were all in school, so I had more time. Mm. This one that I'm writing now is coming up on a year, and it's really kicking my butt, you know. So it's each time, it's not like I've written 20 books. So ask me again in 20 books. But at the moment, each one is pretty terrifying, and I'm not completely confident at any point until it's really done that it's going to work.
So how does that look? So you stop every little bit and kind of outline what you've already done in the past to see if you're on the right track, and then write blind for another couple chapters and then do, okay.
I sort of basically have to go back, and I also go back and so I write every morning. I get up early, I go to work, and I work. I write new stuff. Then if I'm lucky and I have time later in the day, I go back and I look at what I wrote and I edit it a little bit. Then the next morning when I go to work, I start by editing what I wrote the previous day, and I mean a rough polish.
Uh-huh.
And then I hopefully, it's almost like taking a run up, right? And like I read what I wrote the day before, and then I hope that I just launch, it just launches me into the next sentence, whatever it is.
So good.
So, but when I get stuck, I sort of have to back up a bit and write it and work out everything that I've just done and what corner I've just painted myself into in the hopes that then when I lie on the floor, like looking at the ceiling with my ankles crossed, that something is going to come to me and that I'm going to be like, okay. And then you lurch off in another direction. Yeah, it's really not that easy an experience.
And then once you're done, how many revision processes are there to go back through the whole thing?
Well, you know, so far, I do a first draft, which no one sees. Then I do a second draft. Then people see. Then I give it to a couple of people who always read my drafts, who are really good. I have one friend in particular who should have been a book editor. She's so good at identifying what's wrong with a plot and what, you know, where the problem is.
Okay.
So then I'll do that pass. then it goes to the agent, and then the agent makes comments, and then it goes to the editor, and then the editing process starts. But usually by the time it gets to the editor, it's pretty much done.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've gone through 3 or 4 drafts, and I've often rewritten this one that I'm writing now. I have literally started from scratch like 3 times and at one point chucked out 50,000 words that I had already written.
Oh.
Which was a painful day, but yes. It had to be done.
And, so, oh, you know. Wow. I'm just wrapping my, that's rough. And would you say that your process has stayed pretty consistent between the three? I know there were children involved and subject matters involved, and so things are obviously different, but that kind of general process is the process you take every time.
Yes, because there's sort of a period of like flow writing where I'm like really happy and I'm in my zone and I'm like, and I write, I tend to write in chunks for some reason of about 2,000 words. Okay. So I'll sit down and I'll write 2,000 words really fast. And I won't let myself leave unless I've done at least 1,000, right? Uh-huh. These are just completely arbitrary numbers that I have just made up for myself, but that's what seems to work. Like I seem to have a 2,000-word puff, and then after the puff is done, there is no more puff for that day. So I write the puff, and then I go back and I rewrite the puff. But that hasn't changed. What's changed is how big my kids are, how much irritating shit is going on in my regular life. But when I sit down and it's me and the computer and the idea, that's completely consistent.
Yeah.
And always has been since I was a kid. Like, that's always been the way that I like to work.
I love
it. Sort of in bursts.
Love it. I don't know how we ran out of time. I spent too much time at the beginning talking about stuff I shouldn't have been talking about, but now we've run out of time.
I liked all of it. I thought it was all very interesting.
We are interesting, aren't we?
Oh, God, we fascinate ourselves.
I know. Is there last-minute advice that you would give writers, what you've gleaned through the process of 2+ books that are going off now that have helped you?
The obvious one, which is wear layers. Because you can often get quite cold sitting at the typewriter.
Yeah.
And snack. Bring a lot of snacks.
Right.
And never stop.
Drink.
You just have
for God's
to keep going.
Sake, drink.
And it's been agony, this book, this last one, and you just have to keep going back every day. And even though you're convinced that you're never going to be able to write a word again, you just have to.
Yeah. Persistence pays, people. I mean, I've
ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, it really is the persistent person that endures. So yeah, that's great. That's great.
And not to judge too much, just to slap it down on paper, you know,
right.
Slap it down and then go back and fix it later.
Yeah, I think that inclination to edit too early is really destructive. So yeah, I take that advice to heart. Yeah, just to get.
Yeah, I often spend way too much time noodling around at the beginning, making the beginning perfect.
Yeah,
because as a way of avoiding the middle.
Right, the middle is the worst.
The middle sucks. I'm really good at beginnings and endings. The middle is just painful.
Very hard. Abby Waxman, The book is Other People's Houses. The first book was In the Garden of Beginnings. Thank you so much. In the Garden of Small
You're
Beginnings.
You're very welcome.
I screwed that up. This was wonderful.
You
Thank
are very
you.
Welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Kirsten Chen will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will be up and the interviews will be available on the web via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, information on past shows, upcoming shows. And feel free to follow us on, I just started doing this myself, following us on you know, if you just sign up through Apple Podcasts, you can find us on Writers on Writing, and that will give you immediate notification as soon as new shows have been podcast. I don't know why I was so late to that game, but a great way to keep yourself up to date on the show. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward. Kirsten Chen's novel, Bury What We Cannot Take, has been named a most anticipated upcoming book by Electric Literature, The Millions, The Rumpus, Harper's Bazaar, and In Style, among others. She's also the author of Soy Sauce for Beginners, a Kindle First Selection, an O. Oprah Magazine book to pick up now, and a Glamour Club book pick. She was on the show with Nicole Nelson for that show, or for that book back in 2014. You can find a podcast of that up on our website. Kirsten holds an MFA from Emerson College and a BA from Stanford. Born and raised in Singapore, she currently resides in San Francisco, where she's working on a novel about the counterfeit handbag trade. Barry, What We Cannot Take is published by Little A. It came out this past March, and it is the subject of our chat this morning. Kirsten, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
I loved this book, so I'm excited to talk about it. So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce it for our listeners who may not have picked it up yet, kind of talk about this world and your inspiration for writing it.
Sure. So the book, Barry, What We Cannot Take, is set on a tiny island off the coast of southern China in 1957. And when the novel opens, a brother and a sister catch their grandmother defacing the portrait of Chairman Mao with a hammer. And the family gets in trouble and has to flee very quickly to Hong Kong. But when the mother of the family goes to the government authorities to get the necessary exit permits, she's told that she has to leave one of her children behind as proof of the family's intention to return. And so the inspiration for the story, I have to say that I was very, very lucky and fortunate with this book. It started with a story that a dear friend of mine told me many years ago. I think it was maybe 2010. We were out to dinner, and he just started telling me the story about his family. And at the time, I wasn't I was working on my first book, so I thought for beginners, I wasn't thinking about a second novel. But when he told me the story, and, you know, his story is essentially the premise for his book, his father was the little boy who saw his grandmother hammer the portrait of Chairman Mao, and my friend's aunt was the little girl who was left behind in China. The story was just one of those unforgettable stories. So that months later, when it was time for me to start thinking about a second book, that was the story that came back to me almost instantly. Maybe I'd been thinking about it subconsciously all through that time. And so at that point, I asked him if I could have his permission to use it as inspiration for this novel. And I'm so grateful and relieved that he said I could.
It's funny because about 7 years ago or something, I was traveling with my family through the Baltic, and we stopped in Estonia, and there was this little shop that had a big, giant portrait, probably a 6-foot, almost life-size, maybe larger-than-life portrait of Stalin, and it had been slashed with a knife. And maybe they're just trying to trap tourists, but the owner of the shop said, my mother-in-law was the woman who slashed this portrait of Stalin, and she was sent off to a gulag for, a long time.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, because this story, it sounds so so singular, I think, to a Western reader. But, you know, now that this book has been out for a couple of months, I've heard from readers who told me, a friend of mine is a writer and grew up in China, told me that in the 60s, when she was a child, she accidentally smudged the portrait of Chairman Mao and was convinced that her family would be sent to labor camps. It's a story that feels so distant for a Western reader, but I think for anybody who grew up in a totalitarian regime, it's a really familiar tale.
Well, and funny you should say that. I mean, maybe it would have felt distant for a Western reader 5 years ago, and now, amazingly resonant.
Yeah, no, it's been so interesting to see, because I've been working on this book for so long, just how my readers have reacted differently to it over the years and through the drafts, and then also how I've been thinking about the material, when I started the book in 2011, completely different from when I was preparing for the publication of the book.
Right, right. So now we have issues of illegal immigration, all of our immigration issues. We have splitting our children from their parents at the border has been a large topic in the last 2 or 3 weeks in our own country. All of these issues, the Me Too movement, all of these issues are suddenly incredibly resonant. And as you say, when you started writing the book, I'm sure that wasn't entirely the case. But everything old is new again all of a sudden in the world. And I just feel like this book has come out at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that way too. You know, when I first started the book in 2011, it really felt like a story from the past. It really felt like historical fiction with a capital H, you know? And
right.
So it's been really interesting to see how that's changed as the political situation around us has changed and as different stories are in the media, as you said. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. So this is a real departure from your last novel. I mean, it feels much more ambitious. It feels like you've left Singapore, where you grew up, to travel literarily to China.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've tackled several different points of view in this book, as opposed to kind of the first person narrative. So talk a little bit about how that felt to. And second novels are just scary, I think, for novelists in general. I hear. So talk about jumping off.
Yeah, it's a very different book, but I think that I knew that I wanted to write a very different book. I think I spent so much time writing my first novel, which I think is very common for most writers. You know, people say you have a lifetime, or, you know, you have your first sort of 35 years of your life, or however old you were when you published your first book, to be working on your first book, and then you have 5 years to work on your second, right?
Right.
So that's kind of like an old cliche. But yeah, so my first book was, like you said, set in contemporary Singapore, which is where I grew up. It's told in the first person. The narrator bears several surface-level characteristics, shares several surface-level characteristics with me, the author. And so I think that because I had spent so much time immersed in that book, even before I had a topic for the second book, I knew I wanted to work with rotating points of view. That was one of the sort of the only thing that I knew that I wanted to do in my second book. I think because I'd spent so much time writing in the first person prior to publishing my first book, almost every short story I'd written was in the first person. And so I think I'd spent so much time doing that I just wanted to take on a different craft problem. And so that's why I knew I wanted to work with multiple points of view. And then when the story from my friend kind of fell into my lap, really, because I wasn't looking for an idea at the time, I realized quickly how much it would lend itself to the multiple points of view, just because each member of the family has so many secrets. They keep so many secrets from each other that's the kind of story that really lends itself, I think, to the rotating point of view. So it's kind of like the pieces sort of fell together. And it's also my, this second novel is also the first time that I've written historical fiction. So yeah, I took on a lot of firsts with this book.
You did, yeah. Tell me a little bit about tackling some of these points of view. Who gave you the most trouble, and kind of techniques you used to mine their character? The father, Sansan's father strikes me as mm-hmm. one character who could perhaps be a challenge. And I was just wondering kind of how you worked with them.
Yeah. There are five rotating points of view. Each family member has a chance to narrate their own chapters through the book. It's interesting that you point out the father, because he definitely is the character who has, who's perhaps on paper furthest, his experience is perhaps furthest apart from my own personal experience. Right, he's a Chinese man in the 30s, back in 1957. He's the oldest son in his family, and so he's kind of collapsing under the weight of all this family duty. You know, he's responsible for every member of his family. He is maybe the least sympathetic character in the book. I think it's fair to say that he's a terrible husband. He's an absent father. He has a long-term mistress. He's kind of failing at his job. So for all of these reasons, he's a very different character from who I am. But strangely, it was fairly easy for me to access his perspective. And I've been thinking about it a lot, because that is it is a question that I've gotten as I've been touring for this book. And I think that what I really identified with that character was his the way that he was sort of struggling to fulfill his responsibilities to his family, and yet even as he was collapsing under the weight of that, he was still trying to carve out this little path toward personal happiness and personal fulfillment.
Mm.
And that was something that I could really tap into, to my surprise.
Mm.
And so his voice actually came pretty quickly. And the most difficult character to write was actually the grandmother,
mm.
which, again, I tried to kind of figure out why. And it was pretty clear that I was struggling with her, too. Even I think my agent read an early draft, and she was like, what's going on with the voice of the grandmother? She's so distant. And I think that it's because the grandmother is the one character who's lived through incredible hardship. I mean, just she's in her 50s when the book opens, and that particular period of China was just one period of turmoil after another. So, you know, the Communist Revolution was 1949. Prior to that was World War II. Prior to that was I believe, a Japanese occupation of China. Prior to that was Civil War. I mean, there was just, prior to that was World War One. It was just one war-torn period after another. And I thought about how a woman like her would have had to survive. What did she have to do to have to survive all of that hardship? And she was so stoic and so kind of, for lack of a better word, I guess, repressed. Like, her emotions were so pushed down in order for her to survive all of that, that it was actually very difficult to find her voice.
Interesting. Talk a little bit about your research process, because it's got to be daunting. And I'm just trying to figure out when you feel satisfied, you know, kind of if you did the bulk of the research before you started writing, or when you felt, okay, I really have my arms around not only this time period of history, but this place and the smells and the sights and what these characters are going through. Talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah, research is by far the most challenging part of writing the book, even though I just said that I took on all these firsts writing the book. Research is still the hardest part. I think, I mean, it's hard because it's just a really, really complicated time period, and there are people who dedicate their entire careers to becoming experts on this time period, right? And so I feel like I did a lot of research, but the truth is I could have done 10 more years of research, right, and still have had more to learn. And so I think when I initially started writing, I was just sort of plagued by insecurities. I was just I consistently doubted whether I would be able to pull the book off. I would find myself writing sentences and then immediately questioning whether I'd gotten it right. So, for instance, you know, I would write a line like, she, you know, the mother character, Seokun, put a stamp on an envelope, and I would immediately think to myself, oh, what did stamps look like in Hong Kong in 1957? And then I would Google that for half an hour trying to figure it out. And then, you know, like when I was able to take a step back, I would think, but it doesn't matter. Those are the kinds of details that really aren't that important in fiction to get right. You know, like there are things that I really wanted to get right. Like I wanted to understand the political climate, and I really wanted to understand the kinds of pressures that my characters were under. But I didn't need to get all these little details perfect. And so it was kind of finding that balance between figuring out what really mattered for the story and then letting myself be free to imagine the things that weren't as important. It wasn't probably until I finished the first draft that I even figured that out. And through a lot of that, I just sort of forced myself to stop researching. You know, I kind of did this pencils down thing where I'd say, okay, you have 3 months to just read as much as you can about this time period. And then once the 3 months are up, you can't do any more research. You just have to write now for 3 months. And I would highlight the things I wasn't sure about, and I would say, okay, after these 3 months are over, you can go back and fact check all of these things. So it's almost like I had to trick myself into writing that first draft because my insecurities were so strong.
Interesting. That's funny. You're very disciplined, right? I've read you're just a very disciplined writer. So to put that kind of discipline around the research as well as your writing time and the amount you know, give yourself to write each day, it all makes sense to me, but that's funny.
Yeah, I would say that I really respond well to routine.
Yeah, right. That's great. The other thing that I wanted to touch on with the research aspect of this, I totally lost my train of thought here, was one big topic that keeps coming up for us is cultural appropriation lately on the show. And I feel like this has become a topic maybe more in the last 18 months is when I feel like we've started talking about this. And before, I felt like we weren't talking about it that much. And I don't know if you know, the political climate has brought this to a head, or if something else you feel like has happened. But before, I felt like writers felt very free to take on different points of view culturally, racially, genderly, you know, transgenderly. Mm-hmm. And now it's become a little bit more of a thorny topic. And I was wondering your thinking on that as you were working through this, or if that ever kind of clouded your writing head as you were working through this.
Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, I think that was where a big part of my insecurity stemmed from, you know, not just because, well, yes, a big part of it was that it was a challenging topic to research, but also because this was a story that a friend had told me. You know, it wasn't from my family history. And even though I am Chinese, my family is many generations removed from China. So my grandparents grew up in the Philippines. On one side, my great-grandparents migrated from China to the Philippines. Another side, my grandparents migrated to China, the Philippines from China. Excuse me, I got that mixed up. But my family lived, my grandparents grew up in the Philippines, my parents grew up in the Philippines, and then I grew up in Singapore. And so we're already, you know, three or four generations removed from China. And my language, I've lost a lot of my Chinese since I've moved to the U.S. And so for all of these reasons, I wondered whether I had a right to tell this very Chinese story from this particularly traumatic time period. Cultural appropriation was on my mind, even though it's sort of a nuanced issue for me because, again, I am Chinese.
Right.
And this is a part of my history. And even then I felt like I wasn't sure if I had a right to the story. But to your question about why it's been in the news or why it's been sort of talked about more in literary circles, I think you're right. 18 months, 2 years maybe is about when I started thinking about it seriously, too. And I think one of the reasons is because we have more critics of color, and we have where in the past we mainly had majority of critics were white, and and there are more and more prominent writers of color who are speaking out about this. And so, even though I do agree that writers have to be more careful and more considered when they're stepping outside their particular identities, I do hope that it's not all just anxiety. I do hope that it actually leads to, more empathetic renderings of characters, and that it leads to a higher quality of writing and literature. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. We have to worry more, but at the same time, it should be generative as well.
I hope so. I mean, that's really what my fear is who is going, who is going to be the one to tell these really important stories, because unless they're first-person memoirs, I think, whittling down some of the experiences that we're feeling comfortable telling. And, it strikes me that a book like this is so important right now because we need that sort of empathy. We need to see the inside of what these lives look like. And I hope we're not dampening people's courage or ability or bravery to tell some of these stories, because I think they are so important and so important right now. So it's great.
Yeah. And I can from my personal experience, like I said, I definitely thought deeply about this question of cultural appropriation, but I can say that I think I wrote a better book because I was worried about it.
Uh-huh.
I think I went further with my research. I think I asked more questions. I think I really pushed myself to consider the way that I was portraying these characters. And so for me, I feel like that if I had, if I hadn't considered all of these issues, the book wouldn't have come to life the way that it did. So.
Right, right. Good point. My guest this morning is Kirsten Chen. The book is Bury What We Cannot Take. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing. Let's talk a little bit about difficult scenes. There are a number of really hard scenes to read in here, and I would imagine that would make them much, much more difficult to write. And you need to be balancing not being overly precious about us. I don't know if precious is the right word, but being too much on some of these really hard, there are scenes of violence, there are all kinds of these things. And so I would love to talk about which scenes were the most difficult for you and kind of navigating the territory of writing kind of heart-wrenching scenes without giving too much away, I guess.
Yeah. I have to say that I have the opposite feeling that you do.
Ah, okay.
I am a very, very squeamish and also timid reader. Like, I'm easily scared by things that I read, and sometimes I'll have, I have an active imagination and I'll have nightmares from books. And I was worried about that when I had to tackle some of these violent scenes that you said, but I actually found writing them to be much easier because I think I was in control of the scene. And I've been thinking about this a lot because I was wondering, I was surprised that I was able to write these scenes, that they were, relatively, not easy, but that they, that I didn't turn away from them or feel the kind of fear that I feel as a reader. And I think it's because the element of surprise isn't there. So when I'm reading, it's usually the shock element and the surprise element that that really is frightening. But because I'm in control of what's going to happen next, and because I'm so kind of deeply immersed in my character's perspective, I actually felt it easier to write.
It's interesting that you say that, because my next question was going to be, how much of an element of surprise did you allow yourself in this book? And was it, you know, as though somebody, you know, I talk to a lot of writers who say after a while it feels like the characters were writing the book for me and I was just sitting there transcribing what was happening to them. And that element mm-hmm. of surprise for me was incredibly high. I didn't know what was going to happen next, and it was kind of thrilling. I don't know if that was, that doesn't sound like your experience though.
You know, it did in other ways, like not in terms of like, the way that the plot unfolded necessarily. But one really surprising element to me was that when I first started the book, and as I said before, the book rotates through five different points of view, but the little girl is the main character of the book, and she's often described as the protagonist, despite the rotating points of view. But when I first started the book, I thought the boy was going to be the main character, because he's older, and in this particular society, a boy has so much more agency. And in the opening chapters, he really drives the action. And so I thought he was going to be the main character. And then by the time I got to the end of that first draft, I figured out that it had to be the little girl. Like, she had to be the main character because she obviously bears the brunt of the consequences of all of each family member's decision. And that was a surprise that really kind of scared me because, as you know, it's such a, it's a pretty heavy story. It felt like too much responsibility to drape on the shoulders of a young girl. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't sure she would be able to pull it off. And she, as a character, surprised me again and again. She was more resilient, more resourceful than I would have anticipated before I started down that path. And so that was a really, really wonderful surprise. You know, I realized quickly that I had underestimated her, just like every other character in the book. And I think that made a big difference in giving me the momentum to keep going.
Which, again, is such a wonderful message for this time in our country's world life right now, that that women are resilient, that we do have kind of a more resourceful personality sometimes than, or, you know, more resourceful.
Yeah, countries. And also children, you know, I mean, like, yeah. I think about the Parkland teenagers and how, you know, I don't think all of us were underestimated teenagers, and they've just come out in such bravery and courage.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's been the most hopeful part of this last little bit for me. I also want to talk about middles. I think middles of novels are so incredibly difficult. You know, you have all this momentum at the beginning, and, you know, the ending is a nice opportunity to wrap up and see where things ended. But middles are really difficult to sustain reader attention and, you know, to keep up suspense and to keep up interest. And I was wondering if that had also been your experience, that that if it was the middle of the novel that gave you the most trouble. I mean, it didn't feel that way when I was reading it, but I just wanted your insider perspective.
Yes, definitely. You know, I think with both my books, my first and my second, I knew pretty much where I wanted to start, and I also knew where I wanted to end, which I know is pretty rare. In both books, the endings didn't change much either. And so it was really like, how do I figure out how to get the character from the beginning to the end? That took up the years and years that I spent on each of those books. And with this second book, I feel like I've said this before. Like, I kind of had to sort of, the trick is maybe the wrong word, but I do have all of these techniques that I use to kind of just make myself keep writing. You know, and so for this book, because it was rotating points of view, for the first draft, I actually made myself write through the characters' points of view in order. So I just numbered them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I just would go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, over and over again until I got to the end. Isn't that a terrible mechanical way to do
no,
it?
No, that's interesting. I want to hear more about these techniques you use to keep writing. So that's a good one.
Yeah, well, because, like, you know, there were so many points of view, and I didn't even know the story yet. So it's hard to even, I didn't know, I, you know, there are five characters who are each on pretty distinctive paths that cross and that kind of, create obstacles for the other characters. But it was just really, really hard to wrap my mind around each of those things before I had even written an entire draft. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of what I landed on, because, you know, if I didn't know where I was going, I needed some some kind of guidepost. And that was my guidepost. And every time I switched point of view, I would just make myself write a chapter, even if it seemed useless, because I knew I could cut it, you know, I knew I could get rid of it in the next draft.
Yeah. So tell me a few more of these techniques that you use. I know you're very disciplined about the number of words you write a day. You're very disciplined about research.
I mean, that's a big one. I mean, it's almost the same exact thing, you know, as you alluded to. I set out, when I'm drafting, I set out to write 1,000 words a day. And so, I mean, that's just kind of a remarkable thing. It's something that a friend and I landed on. We do that together, and we send each other 1,000 words at the end of every day, just by email. But it's kind of just, I don't know, structured free writing, maybe. Because, you know, if you get to a point where you don't know where you're going and you're kind of pushing yourself to write 1,000 words, then you just have to think of a plot point, or you just have to think of a character that you want to bring into the story. It just kind of forces you to be active about it, as opposed to just saying, well, I'm stuck, I'm going to put it away for a while, which can be useful too.
Right.
You know, but I've always found that I do a lot of my thinking on the page. Like, I'm the kind of writer that writes a lot of drafts. So, you know, 10 drafts with this book, 10 drafts with my first book. And I think that I have a hard time thinking about the book when I'm not actively typing.
Interesting.
So for that reason, the 1,000 words really works for me. It's almost like that's how I think.
Yeah, right. And you turn off the internet, I've read, which is brilliant.
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, my God. I would get nothing done with the internet. And this is also good for this research, because it forced me to not be able to Google things while I was writing.
Right, right. We're drawing down on our time. I can't believe it. But I'd love to hear kind of what this book taught you, both maybe what it taught you in content, like were there surprises that came out of it, and then what it taught you that you will take into the craft of your next book, if you will approach the book that you're working on now any differently as a result of what happened with this one.
I think the biggest thing that this book gave me was just confidence in my ability to tackle a subject that I knew so little about in the onset.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of invaluable as a writer, because it just kind of frees you up to, you know, I think the biggest thing I learned is that I'm not going to reject an idea on face value because I don't think I know enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just now have, I feel like I have the confidence to kind of tackle anything I'm interested in, because I believe in my work ethic, you know, I believe in my stamina now.
And I also think
that with this book, for the first time, and this seems really weird to say because I've been writing for, you know, 10 years since I graduated from my MFA program, but for the first time I can envision a writing career, which is, I mean, I think it's so odd to say to people who have who are in other fields, because they're like, you've been doing this for so long, what do you mean? But with my first book, it felt like, well, if this didn't work out, then I would have to find something else to do it. And, you know, and even if that wasn't true, it just kind of felt like every little, you know, every failure felt like, well, maybe I can't be a writer anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and with this book, I don't feel that way anymore. You know, I feel like, okay, I know, like I said, I trust my work ethic, I trust my stamina. Even if I don't have an idea for a book right now, I know that I'll be able to sustain myself until I do. You know what I mean?
That level of confidence, I think, it really is key for a writer.
It's so hard to get to that place, I think.
Yeah, it
is. But what's for me, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even I talk to writers who have 10 books under their belt, and they're like, still terrifying, number 11, open the Word document, and I'm scared.
And it, really? You know. Oh, no. So maybe I'm in the overconfidence.
No. Well, a healthy respect for the empty page is a good thing, but I'm sure you have that.
That's true, too, yeah.
Oh, Kirsten Chen, never enough time, but this was wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much. I loved your question. So much to think about.
That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.